Are you a scaling SaaS founder?
Ready to make the leap from leading a team to leading an organization? Join us each week as we refill your think tank with actionable tips and strategies from great business minds you know and those who don't know yet. This is SaaS Fuel with your host, five-time entrepreneur, SaaS founder, and globetrotting adventurer, Jeff Mains.
Welcome back to the SaaS Fuel podcast, where building a SaaS is like navigating through space, carefully charting courses around asteroids and using gravity assist to boost our efficiency. I'm your host, Jeff Mains. I help B2B SaaS founders like you grow from traction to scale. Here, growth is more than just numbers. It's about crafting a future-proof company, premium valuation, and leaders who build a business of significance while living epic, adventurous lives. Do you struggle with creating a solid SaaS product roadmap? Constantly juggling priorities and your team is feeling like they're always playing catch up? Yeah, I think I've made every mistake under the sun on this, and many of them twice or 10 times. So let's just skip that and revolutionize the way you approach product development. A well-thought-out SaaS product roadmap is the backbone of successful software development. It's the key to aligning your team, staying on track, and ultimately delivering a product that your customers will love. But the reality is that creating a SaaS product roadmap is no walk in the park. You know, it starts unclear goals, big problem, constantly changing priorities, oh my gosh, big problem. And you know, stakeholders pulling you in a million different directions, customers asking for all sorts of stuff. It's like trying to navigate a ship through a storm without a compass and one dead engine. Welcome to entrepreneurship. Don't worry, this is not insurmountable. I've screwed all of this up just so you can avoid it. I made all the mistakes so you don't have to. And after years of working with world-class B2B SaaS companies, I've identified three essential steps to building a successful SaaS product roadmap that will keep your team on course and your customers coming back for more. The first one is to get really clear on your goals. So what problems are you solving for your customers? What problem do you want to solve? Why do they want to solve it? That's a big one. Why do they care? What is the impact of the problem? And that's really important because if you have a big problem that you solve, then that creates a sticky solution and a pretty big price tag. If you're solving a little problem, then it's something that is optional and you deal with commodity pricing. But when you're clear, test your assumptions and make sure that you're really clear, but then test those assumptions and try to disprove them. Don't go try to make your case. Try to disprove your case. Prove that this is not a problem for your ICP. Do that step well, and so many other pieces will fall into place. And don't forget to revisit this question as you learn more about and engage with your ICP. Can't tell you how many times that we're going a direction. This is the perfect solution. Here's the problem we're solving. And the ICP goes, well, that's a problem over here, but this is a bigger problem attached to it. Oh, okay. We'll go get that one and take this one along with it. Makes a much better solution. So don't forget to revisit that, but challenge assumptions and get super, super clear. And when you think you're clear, go a level or two deeper and really get clear. Step two is to ruthlessly prioritize features. Not all features are created equal. Focus on the ones that will deliver the most value to your customers and align with your goals. The ones that solve a meaningful, measurable, extremely painful problem. It's like chess, you know, you're thinking three moves ahead all the time. So get to know your ICP, know their pain, understand that, and ruthlessly prioritize the things that really matter to them. And this is probably one of the areas that I've messed up the most, and a lot of founders do. I built stuff that no one wanted. I built good ideas, not things that were irresistible. I built what I wanted. I built what a customer asked for. And that's probably one of the biggest challenges. And you might think, you know, but wait, isn't that what we're supposed to do? Build what customers ask for? And I'll actually tell you that story in the next episode. But for now, ruthlessly prioritize features that get the biggest results the fastest. I'll tell you my screw up in the next episode. Step three is to set realistic timelines. This is the second biggest place I messed up. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day. You've probably heard that. And neither is a great SaaS product, although I wish it was, and it is getting better with low code, no code. but break your roadmap into manageable phases and give your team time to do the work. And really the time they need to do their best work, not just do the work. Be careful about doing those quick fixes that you'll come back later and do it right, because those never get done and they pile up. And I've spent 6 months undoing things that we did, you know, 4 or 5 years ago that were quick fixes that we'll come back and fix later. And it really came back to bite us. Now, here's the critical insight that will change the game forever. I used to think that tech moves quick and we should have a very fluid roadmap to adapt to changes. And there is some truth to that, especially early. You know, if you're really early stage looking for product market fit, then it's probably going to be a little bit more fluid. But here's the real game changer. Once you get up, you have that traction and you're ready to scale up, particularly, you know, 2-3 million ARR, 5 million for sure. And you're really looking to go to 10 and beyond. To scale up, a well-structured roadmap isn't just a nice to have. It is the secret sauce to SaaS success, and it keeps everybody much happier. It increases efficiency, reduces risk, which becomes more important, and aligns your entire organization toward a common vision. That gets harder as you get bigger, and it has to be more concrete, that vision, and the roadmap and the plan. So think about it. When everyone knows where they're going and how they're going to get there, magic happens. Your team is more motivated. Your customers are more satisfied. Your business grows faster. And sometimes faster than you ever thought possible. Sometimes out of control fast, which is awesome. So there you have it. 3 steps to building a successful SaaS product roadmap. Define your goals, ruthlessly prioritize those features, and then set realistic timelines. Master those 3 steps and you will be unstoppable. Now, go out there, create a product roadmap of your dreams and your clients' dreams as well. Your team will thank you, your customers will love you, and your business will soar to new heights. So happy roadmapping. Our expert guest last week was Sandy Reise, a thought leader and author in the domain of data engineering. Sandy's the lead engineer on the Dagster project, which is an open source data orchestration platform. We went deep into data pipelines and data orchestration. And our founder last Tuesday was Vlad Guzman, co-founder and CEO of Involve.me. We talked about AI, no code, to leveraging past trends to create a winning company, and how terrible PLG experience led me to his company, Involve.me. That experience was really dialed in. It was great. Some great lessons there as well. If you missed either of those episodes, go back and give them a listen. My guest today is John Conafay, U.S. Air Force veteran and CEO of Integrate. He leads the development of advanced program management software for cutting-edge machines with a systems engineering approach. A rich background and an early employee at 3 space unicorns and key business development roles at ABL Space Systems and Spaceflight, as well as being one of the first 10 at Astranis and Spire Global. Welcome a guy whose expertise in the space industry can only be described as stellar, John Conafay. Hey, John, welcome to SaaS Fuel.
Hey, Jeff, thanks so much for having me. I'm loving the theme of exploration you have going on in the background here.
Without a doubt, it's something I love, adventure. I love seeing new places and exploring. I think your background really lends itself well to that. Tell us a little bit about that, you know, where you came from. How did you get into the space world?
Yeah, absolutely. So moved around a good amount as a kid, D.C., North Carolina, back to D.C., and didn't have the most structured upbringing in the world. So I was very much into the punk and metal scenes when I was a kid. It fostered some type of entrepreneurialism in me that led me to starting a record label when I was 17. Failed miserably from that lack of probably discipline, capital, education. And so after that, I was wandering around, traveling a bit, a lot of cross-country road trips, and then decided to go into the Air Force to essentially get a swift kick in the pants to and a bit of that discipline that I lacked growing up. And for all intents and purposes, it worked. I ended up going to school for economics and design. And while I was there, I was trying to build every different type of app I could think of. You know, one was a partial Snapchat. One was like a peer-to-peer micro-lending platform with both of the people that I started that with actually work in the Seattle office with me today, which is hilarious.
Very cool.
Yeah. And so I went in search of a CTO because I've always been on the business end of things. When I had the record label, I raised money to produce and send bands on tour. And so wasn't going to program the app myself. And went in search for a CTO. So went to all these clubs on campus at Arizona State University, huge campus, obviously, a lot of opportunities, and found a club called Students for the Exploration and Development of Space. The Very local cool. chapter was spectacular, and largely went and fell in love with the space industry from that experience before I went to the national chapter of SEDS USA, and a bunch of buddies and I tore it up from its roots. It was faltering a little bit when we joined. So tore it up from its roots, garnered a bunch of donations from Jeff Bezos and other people, but prepped the organization to receive those donations. And that's really how I got my foot in the door with the space industry. And then it's been, since then, I've worked for 3 space unicorns and since started my own company. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And the company is Integrate.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us about that. What is it? What do you do? How does it work? Who do you serve?
Yeah, absolutely. So we originally started with the space industry in mind because that was my background. Hardware, the space industry is fundamentally collaborative. Your satellite really doesn't have a purpose unless it's on orbit. To get on orbit, right. You can work with a rocket company, unless you're SpaceX. Those usually aren't the same technical challenge. So we originally started in that niche, the ability to coordinate these massively complex launches that were getting more complex seamlessly with external and internal stakeholders. And then we had some Google and Apple engineers beat us over the head and say, this looks like a perfect technical program management software that we've been waiting for our entire careers because we're forced to use, Jira and Smartsheet, which were built for software development originally, and they just don't really suit. So listen to that, went and did a bunch of customer interviews and expanded to, I think this is the world's first technical program management software that's built on a multi-tenant architecture. So we call out collaboration theater, where people say, we're a collaborative platform where you can work with anybody, but it's not quite true. You can send links out to people, or you can send views out to people, things like this, but you can't work on the same items and have your source of truth become their source of truth. So we decided to build that with Integrate, the ability to build out integrated master schedule, tasking requirements and deliverables, all of these things, and then collaborate directly with your vendors, subcontractors, customers.
Wow. That's way beyond the scope of what a couple of other tools could do. I mean, even putting them together.
Yeah.
You're saying, that is pretty comprehensive.
Yeah.
You're definitely going after some large companies. It's not necessarily, small 3-person startups sending people into space or satellites.
Yeah.
Is that something that there was a concern in the beginning, just the sales cycle or the time to get something going?
Yeah. Or is it's definitely a bit of a red ocean. I'm sure my investors or our investors are cringing when I say that, but it is true. When you think of program or project management, you think of Microsoft, you think of Atlassian, you think of Smartsheet, which are, multi-billion-dollar public companies, $1 trillion in some of those cases. But all the software was built 2 to 3 decades ago and wasn't built for the actual collaborative world we live in now. Requirements change every day. Tasking and deliverables, and with globalization has come a fundamental collaboration to every part of hardware building. So we're trying to service that. And we think we're very positive. We have the differentiator in that collaborative aspect to make a big difference. So a worry, sure, but are we worried about it? Maybe naively, no.
Well, collaboration is definitely key, especially in this marketplace, but also agility. And I think you're exactly right. The other products that are in that space, they are dinosaurs.
Yeah.
So there's definitely an opportunity here. Maybe red ocean.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
A real opportunity to bring in something new and bring it into the space age.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. I appreciate that very much. Yeah. That's one of the biggest things that drove me crazy at all the last companies or all the companies I was part of before is, we're trying to build these massively complex machines, rockets, satellites to go on rockets, and trying to de-risk all of the time. But programs a world over are built in a way that isn't conducive to building complex machines. So what we say is it's program management currently, and with the software suites that people use currently, is much akin to trying to conduct an orchestra or symphony while sending all of the musicians to their individual rooms and then texting them snapshots of the music every 2 weeks. You just get these very parsed out specific timelines that have changed by the time they've reached whoever they need to reach. And so it's not really conducive to building complex machines in an agile way.
Yeah, I can't imagine the delays and just the slowness of systems and something like that, where that's a really good mental picture.
Awesome.
Because by the time they get it, it's probably changed anyway, and it's outdated. And this is probably one of the reasons that projects take a really long time.
Yeah.
Is because they don't have integrated technology where people are communicating
exactly.
In real time.
Yeah. I was just listening to Predictable Growth, of course, because I don't think you can be a SaaS startup founder without reading it.
Yeah.
Predictable Revenue. And they very much drive home the point of, the passing of the baton from a software or an SDR to an account executive is where 80% of the problems happen. And
wow.
We somehow standardize that or take that as completely okay and reasonable for these massively complex programs where you're passing the baton all the time because nobody actually gets to keep their source of truth and then parse it out as necessary so that your source of truth becomes source of truth for others as well. And I just woke up one day and was like, this is insane. How are we, why are we doing it this way? Yeah.
I love that. I mean, you're solving a problem that you've experienced. And I think that's fundamentally different than somebody looking at the outside going, hey, that looks like a problem. I could probably solve that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And is that the way you approached it? Was, based on your experience and kind of the things that you had done in your previous roles, here's a problem that I had, and here's the way that we can solve it.
Yeah, 100%. It was, sample size was less than n is equal to 30. Sample size was not 30, but it was 4. I worked in 4 hardware startups, deeply involved with, whether it's costing, bill of materials, management, procurement, supply chain, whatever it is, deeply involved in that process for most of them, from small teams all the way through hyper growth stages. And so I saw it firsthand, and seeing it 4 times in a row seemed like a pretty safe bet that it's not just these companies having these growing pains.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a really unique set of experiences as well. 3 space unicorns and 4 hyper growth companies in that space.
Yeah.
What lessons did you learn from the experiences there that helped you in the current role and in current product at Integrate?
Yeah. I think my entire team might puke when I say this because they hear it from me so much, but velocity matters at this stage. It's not unless you're able to pick something up at the exact right timing that just lights on fire, it takes a lot of work to actually get something, bring something so complex and new to the market. And a lot of the only things you can't really dilate time, but the only way that you can is to be faster, to ship faster, to produce faster, and, making sure you have an eye on quality. So velocity truly does matter. Smaller teams can work faster and more accurately, hopefully, than large teams. And, if my job is to keep the lights on and increase luck surface area to make us as successful as humanly possible, one of the biggest hacks you can have is to ensure that you're moving fast enough to capture whatever luck comes your way.
I think that's a fantastic lesson. What else did you learn at the companies that you brought forward?
Yeah, I think I've had really spectacular bosses and some not so spectacular, but very few not so spectacular. Like, I've had some really incredible experiences with leadership. I've worked directly for founders at pretty much every job I've had. So that's been spectacular. There was a stark difference between people that delivered feedback frequently and directly, and then the passive aggressive bosses that just let stuff stew or brew until they were pissed off about something and didn't actually address it in the moment. So that's something that I carry through, because I look back at some bosses that I took completely for granted because I had zero perspective or zero understanding of the pressures that they were under, and where, the things that I was probably kicking or screaming about at the time ranked maybe 50th on their priority list. So I have that perspective now. which is spectacular. But something that I try to carry through is that direct and frequent feedback as opposed to, you know, sitting on it or letting it stew, because how are people supposed to improve or change or adapt, which being a part of a startup is all about adapting because everything's changing all the time. If they don't know what's going on or what needs to adapt or change, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. When I think about the aerospace and defense industry, it seems like, you know, a lot of the companies are big, very corporate. Some of them maybe older. You know, culture is different in different companies. Have you seen things that where you see a culture mismatch between companies, or have you seen things in other companies and say, hey, we want to bring that in here and make that part of our culture, or both?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it actually really goes back to that direct feedback and open and honest conversations, because, you know, I've seen behavior that sort of rots a company from the inside if it's not really nipped in the bud. And a lot of it is politics or people empire building within a company, or, you know, withholding information. People call it mean girl. It's mean anyone kind of behavior that happens that I've really disliked. And so if I catch any kind of whiff of maneuvering, I'm not a huge fan of it in our company. I like people that are direct, open, you know, don't be afraid to speak truth to power or to each other and call things out when they're wrong. Probably comes a lot from the Air Force safety culture and then hardware safety culture, is if you're not, you know, loud about something that's going wrong, somebody could get an arm chopped off or electrocuted or something like this. So it has been a change, though, because I don't think that's the standard in or learning opportunity for me very much, because I don't think that's necessarily a standard in software companies or building software specifically, because you can fix things. People aren't going to die if a bug, you know, goes out, unless it's mission critical hardware, you know, something like this, but a flap's not going to close on somebody's arm or anything like this. So that direct, and I'll just outright say abrasive nature on my part, which is, you know, call things out as you see them, I've had to tweak and learn how to rein in a little bit from the hardware cultures, for sure.
Yeah. But it's helpful too. I mean, people don't have to wonder where they stand. They don't have to wonder, you know, or is this the right direction? Am I doing the right thing? Do I understand this? Because there is that feedback loop, which I think is really, really helpful.
Hopefully. Yeah. That's the I keep looking back at experiences where I won't name them, so, you know, so I don't send anybody spinning off, but I had one boss that I fully took for granted, and they were one of the most incredible bosses I could have possibly had. And they were under immense pressure. So, you know, working hours weren't the most important thing to them, which now I completely understand. And I'm like, oh man, if I had stuck with them just a little bit longer, the things I could have learned. But it is, I think that being a part of a direct feedback culture takes time to appreciate, and, you know, it hurts while you're in it. You know, like you're getting all this feedback and it's like, can I do anything right? But I look back at a lot of those bosses that honestly gave me the gift of direct feedback and appreciate them so deeply now.
Yeah. And feedback isn't always negative.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
there's certainly a lot of opportunity for positive feedback too.
Very much so. And we like to celebrate, for sure. We're not shy about celebrating, I hope.
So how did your experience in the Air Force influence, you know, your career choices and then, you know, what you're doing today?
Yeah, I'm going to have, if a former boss hears this, he's going to laugh his head off when I say this, but actually probably all of them, but attention to detail was really drilled into us in the Air Force. I think those bosses that laugh wouldn't be laughing if I hadn't gone into the Space Force. It would have just been a disaster, my attention to detail. And so that was something that was drilled into me. A lot of, I don't know how this is going to come off, but respecting yourself enough to take care of things in a way that shows integrity and shows the people around you that you're here to get work done. So whether it's getting up early, you know, being reliable on time, 15 minutes, you know, 10 minutes early is 5 minutes late kind of thing. I don't hold a lot of other people to that standard because I've lived in California for at least 2 years and it's a different world, you know, but
it is.
Yeah. You can tell people that have a certain way about carrying themselves that have gone through that gauntlet and realized that the way that they do carry themselves matters in the way the company's represented and things like this. So that's been something important. Integrity and being able to call out when you've screwed up you know, we have a sign in the office that says "Don't F up," and it's largely a joke because stuff happens. Period. But as long as you're able to take ownership of those mix ups and we're able to hop on them, you're not going to get chastised for screwing up. You just call it out and own it. You know,
yeah, that's a whole lot better, a whole lot different than, you know, cultures that are you know, blamers or pointing the finger. Or, hey, you know, it's not my fault. It's somebody else's.
Yeah.
You know, the empire building, like you said, it really trying to keep that silo intact. And, you know, as long as somebody else's head's on the chopping block, that's fine. But that doesn't work.
Yeah.
And when you're talking, you know, collaborative environment, and that's the whole thing that your software does too.
Yeah.
Makes it, you know, very collaborative.
Yeah.
Let's say you have great programs.
Yeah, exactly.
Successful programs.
Yeah. Yeah. You need accountability and you need people to step up and say when something's broken. Yeah.
But picture this, your entire team aligned and unstoppable, building a future-proof business with total clarity on what success looks like. It's easier than you think with Champion Leadership Group. Whether growth is booming, a little bit flat, or you feel like the world's best-kept secret, we've got you covered. Ditch those time-sucking spreadsheets for a SaaS operating system that turbocharges your team with scorecards and KPIs built into a SaaS. It makes leading the company 10 times easier and you 20 times more effective. Add that to a community of scaling SaaS founders and on-demand access to a fractional C-suite. It's all designed to unlock your company's full potential, support higher valuation, and elevate you from engaged operator to empowered owner. Say goodbye to manual madness and hello to a world-class business. Now is the time to upgrade from traction to scale. Learn more at championleadership.com. That's where leaders evolve and companies transform.
Yeah, that's especially important when the stakes are as high as they are in some cases.
Yeah.
Multi-million dollar projects.
Yeah, the balance between, you know, there are a few things that, you know, pixel imperfections or some places that things can fail in the name of speed, but there are a few places where it absolutely cannot in our instance, and we drive those home. And I think having experience around hardware companies as much as they have is, you know, I forgot who told me this, but it was really spectacular. There are rubber balls and there are glass balls, and some balls can fall off the table. You know, you're so overloaded, that's going to happen sometimes, but it better not be the glass balls that fall off the table, and you need to know which ones are which. And I think we take that very much to heart with regard to security, as well as ensuring that timing and everything is accurate in our application.
Wow, that is absolutely brilliant. I've got to remember that.
I got to remember
that down. Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah.
Well, in building the company, what are some things that were maybe surprises or challenges you didn't necessarily expect in going from, you know, building a team, leading a team to leading an organization?
Yeah, my limits are things that were very...
That's true for all of us.
Yeah, I didn't realize a lot of times, I think just about every person starts a company, looks back at their early days and cringes, or, you know, a little bit at how they might have handled specific situations. And I think not realizing when I was running in the red as much as I was, and how my responses, whether frustrated, angry, like outright angry, or however they are, not taking that time to look inward and see why I'm reacting in those ways, because it's generally not anybody else's fault that my reaction is too much, you know? So that's something that has taken a little bit of time to learn and that I'm still learning and working on constantly. And then the biggest, the most jarring difference, I think, was the hardware to software move. Speaking of that safety culture in hardware companies and how direct and how, you know, this is how it goes. This is what needs to get done. I was also a flight line maintainer while I was in the Air Force, and we were notorious for, I'm surprised I haven't slipped up and cursed once yet, being that way and very direct and loud and abrasive. And so realizing that's a different world that most software developers live in was a change, and something that I very much had to change in myself or work on myself. And then that software is wildly complex. You know, everything is hard for different reasons. and software is hard for very real, very specific reasons. So learning from our software engineers this entire time continuously has been huge for me.
Yeah, that's really good. Great lessons. I think, you know, hitting their limitations, that's something that I face regularly.
Oh, yeah. And that's
you bumping up against that and wow.
Yeah.
Or looking back.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And you founded what, 4 or 6 startups yourself?
Yeah. 5. Yeah.
Yeah. 5. Yeah. And I think the most shocking thing to me was realizing that I'd built such a tolerance for stress and everything that I didn't, until it got to a dangerous level, because I'd worked so many startups, until it got to a dangerous level for my health, for, you know, whatever reason, it was just this in my bones kind of way of being and tolerating the stress. And there are, you know, certain milestones or timelines, if you're under a year of runway or anything like this, where you just start to acknowledge the kind of deep in your bones stress that you might not have acknowledged or taken for granted before, that sits there and really closes the window of your stress response significantly. And so learning that's been very interesting where that sits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Well, you talked about software challenges. And one of the things that I think really sets Integrate apart from, you know, other competitors in the space is you've really built a multi-tenant, you know, true SaaS solution.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's, what were the challenges around that?
That was
easy.
No problem whatsoever.
It's just typing.
When you have 6 different entities interacting on one object, being able to catch all of the edge cases for how they interact or the user interface edge cases and not allowing them to do specific options, it's an exponential complexity curve when you get into multi-user interactions, because there's, with the majority of software today, like I said, you can send a link out and people just get that very compartmentalized view of an object or of a schedule or something like that. And it doesn't matter because they're not working with it live. You don't run into race conditions where 2 people are editing the same thing like you do with Google Docs,
right,
and things like this. And our entire value prop is that you're able to have your source of truth, hold it completely private, and just meet out very tiny parts of subtasks, tasks, you know, one requirement to an external stakeholder or something. And so developing all of the protections around that, all the protections around role-based access control, you know, I've heard a bunch of people say, you know, we'll build the product and then we'll go back and flip a few switches in SQL database and we'll have a multi-tenant enterprise application that's fully collaborative. I can't cover this entire microphone, but
Yeah.
You will, you know? I mean, it's,
yeah, you've got to architect it that way from the very beginning. If you get to the end and want to try and go back,
yeah,
you're screwed.
Yeah, exactly. It is a monstrous task. And that was another huge learning curve, is there were definitely moments where I was like, did we make a gigantic mistake building it this way because of the complexity and testing, because of the, like, anything that you would have to test, write one test for, you have to write 20 tests for, because you have to do it from all of these different user angles and configurations. But now it's one of our greatest strengths. I mean, now that we're over the hump and we really have a great handle on all those user interactions, that feels like how we win the market, you know, all these massive network effects.
That's really good. Yeah, it's a tough thing, but once you do have it and you do it well, it certainly creates a moat around the solution.
Yeah,
it's something that's very unique. And just thinking about, you know, all of the use cases, I mean, my mind is just, you know, edge cases and race conditions.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much complexity to that.
Yeah.
And getting that figured out and architecting that way from the beginning is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. Shout out to both our chief architect, co-founder, Paul, for bearing with me through, you know, not understanding how complex it was, first of all, and then our other co-founder, Andrew Sloan. You know, this would have been even more difficult if we had not had a design lead or design led mentality for the application, because of all this UI UX consideration and understanding. So shout out to both of them for being able to take something that I didn't necessarily realize was as novel as it is while ideating. But that's one of the greatest things about startups is, you know, if you knew all of the hardships you're going to encounter, you probably never start. So you got to be a little bit crazy, dumb, ignorant, naive, whatever it is to keep going, right?
A little of all of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, without a doubt. Well, you bring up an interesting point too. Thinking about co-founders, and you know, what role do you think co-founders play in building successful organizations, and how has that worked out for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's worked out really well in our case. I mean, it's the hacker, hustler, hipster kind of combination. You know,
I like it. Which one are you?
Well, the hustler for sure. I've been in sales in one way or another for the past 12 years. And then we have the hacker, you know, Paul that actually built the first iterations, and then the hipster and Andrew, who did all of our marketing, all of our branding, which I'm wildly proud of, not only the complex, incredible application that we built, but the forward face of the company. And I wouldn't have been able to do a quarter of it. You know, we're all kind of force multipliers for each other in the way that we challenge each other and push each other to go farther or faster or harder or however we do it. Get weirder. That's a big thing that we say to each other. It's get weird. Get, you know, figure out just like the most crazy, insane solution you could probably think of. And then we'll work backwards from there. Or, you know, if we're holding a party, if we protested one of our own parties in a Gojira costume saying, keep hardware card, Gojira. And, you know, we always push each other to get weirder and think as far outside of the box as we possibly can, because we're not trying to build another Jira. We're not trying to build another Smartsheet or Microsoft project. We're trying to build something synonymous with hardware engineering that when people think of building something complex, their first thought is integrate, you know.
That's really smart. I think it's great having the combination of the people, but really smart in the way you're thinking of, you know, pushing the boundaries, not just recreating something because somebody else has something like that. What's the next iteration? What's the next level? Do you feel like pioneers in the space in trying to create something that's new, that's not just...
Yeah, nothing ever feels that cool while you're in it, right? You know, so pioneers...
pioneers, that's a cool word. Yeah, it'll feel like that looking back.
Yeah, it's a cool word, and I would love to feel like that looking back. You know, right now we just feel like a bunch of fighters. It feels like we're, you know, putting our war paint on to continue the battle to go to market, and it sounds ridiculous and silly when there are actual wars going on in the world. Don't get me wrong. I take the gravity of those, but very seriously, I keep thinking of the Ben Horowitz book, The Hard Thing About Hard Things.
And great book.
Unbelievable book. I've read it like 3 times at this point. I remember I was sitting in the car going to Space App Seattle with one of our engineers, and they started talking about peacetime and wartime CEOs. And I'm not the most level-headed person in the world. I wish I was. You know, there are a lot of qualities I would love to improve about myself. But they went into the wartime CEO description, and she just looked over at me like, you jerk. But the reality of it is we're, you know, until you're at like a Series B true growth stage, you're at war with the market fundamentally. And 90% of the time, the market wins. So we've got to keep that death is top of mind at all times mentality, so that we don't get complacent or we don't slow down. And it adds stress, but I think it's a good, healthy type of stress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you balance that in, you know, really building the company and you know, that wartime CEO and pushing forward and thinking about, you know, the things that you have to do to be successful to get to that point?
A lot, something that I'm working to improve constantly is a lot of education. If somebody hasn't necessarily come from a small company before, you got to start educating people in the interview process that this is not a place to come to be comfortable, frankly, you know, and you have to screen for it.
Yeah.
We've had a few false starts with really spectacular people that just couldn't necessarily wrap their head around the fact that this is not a 10 to 3. This is a 6 to 6 if we're lucky every day, you know, and this is things aren't going to be taken care of. If you don't have a step-by-step guide to our CI/CD process, you got to go ask somebody, or you got to figure it out, or you might even have to build it, you know? So I think education for people before they even start the interview process. We just hired a head of sales whom I'm super, super excited about. And the difference between him and the majority of other candidates was You know, he's worked at big companies and small companies, but he knew that there would not be much support. You know, he's going to be on an island and expected to deliver and produce from day one, frankly. And he just got it. And if it's still a responsibility of an early stage CEO or early stage team to educate and catch those people and make sure they know they're supported in every possible way that we can. But if there is not a job function in the company right now, it's probably the CEO or one of the founders' jobs. And so to know that it's not for lack of trying. Yeah,
that's a fundamental difference. I mean, coming from a big company to a small one, you know, you don't have people and staff just to throw things out to or get help with. Sometimes you got to figure it out on your own or, like you said, build it.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't exist and you need it. Well, it's time to build it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we have, our team's been spectacular about that. Like it always gets me giddy when one of our incredible engineers is like, oh yeah, I got really excited about this tool we've been needing for the past 3 months. And so I built it last night and it's just going to make everybody's lives so much easier. I'm like, hell yeah, that's
awesome.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. It's really,
yeah, cool. Those are great days when somebody does something and I didn't ask them, I didn't even know about it. I didn't even know it was a problem. And they're like, this was a problem. It's been that way for this long and I fixed it.
Yeah, exactly.
That is awesome.
Yeah. And celebrating those publicly very much. Feel like that's the juice. That's what gets us going. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
What are the biggest lessons you've learned since starting Integrate?
Oh, man. I say this every single time, but I've definitely apologized to all my former founder bosses. The stuff that I was worried about didn't rank, you know, before. If you don't laugh at some of the BS that happens, you'll break eventually. And, you know, I had 1 week a few weeks ago, we're just the most insane mistakes from a certain department of revenue or, you know, like funding, you know, foibles or things like this, just stuff that would have floored me and scared the ever living hell out of me when I was, you know, just getting out of the military or just starting school or anything like that. It was like a daily occurrence, you know, and it's not because everything's breaking or falling down. It's just, there's so much in going to market and in, you know, accounting, finance, HR, you know, making sure your people are healthy, happy, and feel secure. There's just so much that's outside of your control that the things that are within your control sometimes don't rank as what to fix, you know? So I think that has been hilarious and spectacular to learn. And that's, you know, that's what we signed up for. I wouldn't be in startups if I didn't get a little bit of a kick out of the constant firefighting, right?
right.
And then something that was very surprising because I've always been a really social person is it's lonely. It's really, you know, there are a lot of things, and I know this is trite and a lot of people say it, but there are a lot of things that you just don't want to talk to people about, not to hide it from them or for a lack of integrity, but just because you've got to hold them, you know, until you hire somebody else to hold them, because it's easy for people that don't have all of the context to freak out about stuff, and it's totally reasonable, but you've just got to hold on to that stuff and take care of it and sometimes do it completely alone. And you know, being scared alone is 10 times more scary than being scared with other people. So that's
without a doubt.
So that's been interesting. What RPM to run the company at has been a big lesson, because you can't just redline it constantly, knowing when to, all this stuff is things that people have said a million times, but you don't necessarily know until you do it. I think one of the biggest lessons is that sales and raising money are two different things completely. You know, if you are wildly excited and exuberant and just go in with these bombastic, you know, we're the future of this, it'll turn a lot of people off that are buying a product, but that's completely different from raising money. And so that was a way I held myself back. You know, no matter how much I believe in the company that I'm building, I always temper it with, you know, reality of market conditions and things like that. I think that was an interesting lesson for sure. Yeah,
that is very different. How have you thought about fundraising? Or how do you approach it? You know, what's the thought process behind it? And, you know, what have you done in that regard?
Yeah, so we've raised a total of about 4.5 $4.5 million, sorry. With 3.4 in July of last year, and then for a seed round, then 970,000 for that in June of 2022. And I'm still very much of the mind that you raise as little as humanly possible to get to where you need to be so you could stand on your own 2 feet. I speak about increasing luck surface area. I could not be, and this might sound like lip service, I don't really do lip service, but I love the investors that we have, you know, Ravel and Riot, Hyperplane, Village Global, and then our incredible angels, not in that order, you know, by any means, all bring really spectacular view to the organization and just been wildly supportive. But I don't want to raise money unless we absolutely need to, which is a bad time to raise money anyway, need to grow faster or get bigger or any of these things. So I always try to keep in mind that, you know, the 2021 ZERP cycles were not a great place to be. You know, I can't imagine I wouldn't have taken advantage of it if I had the opportunity. At the same time, you know, raise as little money as possible to get to where you can stand on your own 2 feet and balance that with growth. Probably a little bit more pragmatic on the venture funding side.
Yeah. Well, that's really smart. And you're not just taking dumb money. There's a reason and there's input and support and things with that. So exactly. I think that's really important that you really have that good alignment. Not a lot of people have that great feedback about their investors.
Yeah.
Some of it's mediocre and some of it's good.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is, we'll just say less so.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think it's a really smart way to approach it.
I appreciate that. Lucas, who just announced his fund, Ravelin, is essentially a follow-on investor because he was the one that led the round at Village Global for a pre-seed and then first out of his new fund, which is really spectacular. And that dude has worked. I mean, I've always gotten accused of being the most too responsive. Do you just have your phone directly plugged into your brain at all times? Like, what the hell is your problem? And this guy beats me on every metric. And then, yeah, it's insane. And just, I mean, I was on the phone with him at 6 a.m. the other day, working through some go-to-market stuff. And, you know, and then we have Rags from Hyperplane on our board, but it's like we have all six of the people, or six or seven of the people that work at Hyperplane on our board, because they just really take this community collective approach to helping in whatever way they can. It's been spectacular. And then, you know, Megan and Steve from Riot are just so incisive. I mean, they just can get it into the dirt and weeds with you and know the market as well as anybody. But it really came down to each of them understood the problem we were solving really well and immediately. Because we spoke to so many investors where we would have to spend 25 minutes of a half hour pitch just explaining what hardware is and the complexity of hardware. And then we would have 5 minutes to pitch. And it was miserable. And then, you know, getting right in with Hyperplane, Riot, Ravelin, Village Global, where they just were like, we've heard this problem. We know this problem absolutely immediately because they've lived it. They'd been previous operators. It's been world changing.
And that's exactly what you want out of a funding team is to have that connection, those relationships, and they get it. They're all in and really understand what you're doing.
That's absolutely.
Really, really smart.
Yeah.
Where can people learn more about you and about Integrate Online?
Yeah. We have a website that splits people 50-50 on whether they love it or hate it because it's very much us. So I'd encourage anybody to go to integrate.co and drop us a line on, you know, which side of the coin you fall on, whether you love it or hate it, or if it's, you know, giving you seasickness, or if you're just all on board with how loud the brand is. You know, drop us a comment or sign up for a demo if you're building hardware and check us out, integrate.co.
And it is a great website. It's unique. Everybody should go there and check it out because it's like nothing you've ever seen. And I think it just goes with the kind of the hipster marketing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that is out there. It's not normal. It is very unique. It's 100% you.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
They're very memorable. So, awesome. And I do like the site.
Awesome. Thanks. Thanks. I would have been thinking about that for a while afterwards.
And we'll make sure and link all of that in the show notes, including a link to the site. And awesome. So people can find that there along with the socials and other information. John, fantastic conversation. Thanks for being on SaaS Fuel.
Thanks so much, Jeff. Really appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
Thanks again, John, for coming on the show and sharing your journey and insight. So good. You can learn more about John and his company Integrate at integrate.co. As always, all links, highlights, resources, and full show notes are available at sasfuel.com. And be sure to check out our YouTube channel, shorts, highlights, training, outtakes, lots more stuff there. Thought leaders share. So share this episode with someone who is passionate about space. It's a great way to connect interests through conversation. And everyone who shares this week gets a galactic Gantt chart. It's a project management tool that maps out your task on a stellar scale, ensuring you navigate the complexities of your projects with the precision of a spaceship pilot. I mean, this is a thing that even Han Solo would be envious of. Join us Thursday on our SAS Fuel Expert Series, where my guest is John Sarver, Navy veteran, innovation and technology consultant at SAS Logic. We'll be talking about usage-based pricing, hybrid billing systems, and pricing to win. And next Tuesday, we have our third John in a row. Wasn't planned that way, just three awesome people with the same name. John Miller is founder of Scribewise, and he is revolutionizing B2B marketing with a bold approach that champions courage over conformity. If you want to add some boldness to make your marketing stand out, this is absolutely for you. So I will see you next time, and as always, enjoy the journey.
Thanks for listening to SAS Fuel. Full show notes for each episode, which includes a summary, key takeaways, quotes, and any resources mentioned, are available at sasfuel.com. Be sure to follow and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you're enjoying the content and getting value from these episodes, please leave us a rating and review at ratethispodcast.com/sasfuel. We'll be sure to read these out on future episodes. Let's go!